It's time for your network break. Get a virtual donut and your favorite caffeine delivery system and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Connery Murray. Greg Farrow is on the other microphone. Today's show is sponsored by IT Pro TV. You can learn the skills you need to pass the most in-demand IT certifications from entry-level to advanced. Just visit itpro.tv/network and use the code NETWORKBREAK, and you can try it free for 7 days and receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And check out our new subscription site, ignition.packetpushers.net, for exclusive Packet Pushers content with free and paid membership tiers. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. All right, Greg, before we start the news, I just wanted to say the long nightmare is over. We have migrated the website.
Yes. I've been warning you for a few weeks there now about migrating the website, and we did cut it over. It was long and it was painful. And to be fair, I wrote up a blog post. So if you want some sort of a blame storming and where I explain sort of what happened, but the main things that went wrong were that we froze the website Monday last week. We published a couple of blog posts, and then the data export was done. And then the data export took longer, and there were some troubles once we got to the other side. And so we just kept publishing and said, we'll catch it up. And then we migrated. And in the process of that, the feeds got themselves messed up because they saw content from the old site. And then when we republished from the new site, and then on top of that, we had a change with the podcasting plugin. And if you're troubleshooting XML metadata, your life is very, very short. I promise you, it's not that much fun. So it took me a while to get everything sorted out, but it's now all stable and good to go. We also had a couple of problems where, because the feed sites, I was pushing the feeds around from place to place. You might have seen some doubling up, for which I apologize. It was the one thing I was really hoping. The way that RSS feeds work is they rely on a thing called a GUID. It's just a unique identifier that most RSS feeds look at. And there's a URL in the GUID. And sometimes it was flipping around. And that's when your RSS feed reader says, oh, that's new. Or your podcatcher says, oh, if the GUID's changed, that must be a new thing. That's the unique key. And I think for most people, it didn't actually change. The GUID itself is actually completely invalid compared to where we used to be. But hey, there's not much I can do about that for now. Something that's going to take a lot of effort to fix. So it's all stable. It's all done. I'm not going to fiddle with it anymore. And I apologize for any service outages or too much downloading. It should be much faster and better now. So there.
Right. And we did have to delay publishing some podcasts because of this. And you may have had some issues with your feeds. We apologize for that. Everything should be straight now. And by migrating to the new site, performance should be better. We went to HTTPS, so the site is secure. Everything's encrypted. But yeah, I know Greg was ripping out his hair trying to parse all this. I just want to note, I watched some conversations, Greg, you had with folks in our Packet Pushers Slack channel, and it just goes to show how great it is to have a community, because you were getting some advice from folks who deal with web servers all the time, and it looks like they pointed you in the right direction in a few places.
Yeah, you dig yourself a hole and you start seeing the things that you can see, and you don't know what you're not seeing. And this is where it's so valuable to be part of a team, because you have somebody comes in and says, I'm seeing this, and you're going, what do you mean? And then all of a sudden you go, oh, that's not the problem, that's not the issue, it's over here. But my brain was so fixated on the things that I was looking at, it just didn't make sense, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And so it was really great to be able to fix all of that. So, and I think it's going to work out for us in the long run for all of us, because the website, we used to be hosted on a managed service from somebody, and that company has basically gone under. It's managed and organized. They're selling the business off to somebody else who's effectively going to sink it. So we had to lift the website out. We didn't have a choice here. We wouldn't have stuck with it if we could have, but we had to do something. But the main thing is now website's IPv6. It's fully SSL encrypted. The feeds, I took the opportunity, seeing as I was breaking the feeds, to fix the feeds so they're all SSL and encrypted. So that should see things getting faster, but also, you know, they get ranked better and so forth in the things. So it should be, overall, it should be a much better experience for everybody.
Yeah, and thanks to those people who provided some outsider perspective and insights. So that was helpful.
Yeah, the Slack channel, the Packet Pushers Slack channel, pretty great. Lots of great people.
A win for the community, for us.
Yeah, certainly. Definitely, I think, yeah.
All right, well, mea culpa, and hopefully things will be fine from here on out. So let's do what we're supposed to do here. We're going to talk about the news. The big story this week, Cisco Systems and Arista Networks, they've agreed to dismiss all litigation related to the patent lawsuits that the two companies have been filing against each other for the past few years. As part of the deal, Arista is going to pay Cisco $400 million. They've also agreed to a five-year deal not to bring any new patent or copyright infringement suits against each other for existing products, and a three-year deal where they'll use arbitration rather than lawsuits to resolve any patent disputes that may arise over new products.
So this all sounds fairly normal. Like, it might sound pretty weird, you know, 5-year deal, but this is the standard legal argy-bargy that goes on between these companies. And I don't see it as, generally I don't see either side as having won here, which means it's almost the perfect law case, lawsuit, right? You know, like they say, if anybody wins in a court, then something's gone wrong. Everybody should come away unhappy. I think one of the things to really point out here is Cisco really hasn't been able to land a killing blow in the court case. So when the court case started up, Cisco sounded really confident that they had something they were going to nail Arista where all the way back in 2014. Do you remember that?
Yeah, it was this one around the CLI? There were several lawsuits around copyright and CLI infringement, and it did seem like Cisco really felt like they were going to just essentially obliterate Arista and knock them out of business.
Yeah. Now, some of it's just posturing and some of it's just the way you want it. You know, if you're going to go out there and go after a competitor like this, then all right. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, it did seem like Cisco thought we can legally just steamroll Arista here. And for a while, it looked pretty tough, but Arista had some technical workarounds that they were able to put in place that sort of satisfied some of the issues. And then things just kept going from there.
Yeah, I did really think that, you know, they came out so aggressively, they really felt they had something, was my conclusion.
Cisco did?
Yeah. They really came out heavy and they made a substantial media push to sort of say, they're in breach. They're the bad people. They're naughty. They've stolen our stuff. They took our people. They took all our toys and they're playing with them. And gosh, you know. And then very quickly it turned into whiny, whiny, whiny instead of like, you know, we're on a moral high ground. And I think it very quickly turned around that Cisco was actually validating Arista as a competitor. It sounded much more like actually Arista's taking market share and we're going to try and use the legal system to try and beat them. And or to slow them down or to get a position on. Do you remember that phase?
Yes, it did seem like kind of a rear guard action. Like, we're having trouble beating them in the market, so we're going to try this legal route instead. And if not obliterate them, at least sort of slow them down, throw some FUD up into the air, make customers or more potential customers worried about investing or buying from Arista. But the strategy didn't really work.
Yeah, like I talked to a lot of people and they sort of said, you know, oh, what if Arista gets hammered by it? It did work. But then it started not to work.
For a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, it didn't last very long. Customers really want to. I think to some level, I mean, first of all, Arista's quick response when they basically said, yeah, we're just denying a design around those patents and it won't be a big deal. And then they just went to customers and said, we can't. The big one was the private VLANs feature. And they said, look, we just can't give that to you anymore. Cisco says you can't have it. And that's literally how I've heard it pitched, is you can't have it because Cisco said so. So it's not our fault. And transferred the blame to Cisco. And customers just went, okay. And there was some kerfuffle with, you know, products being suspended, like they weren't able to import some gear for a couple of months. But Arista seemed to have found ways all the way around that. So the customers were pretty much buoyed up and investors were sort of buoyed up about the whole thing. And they've continued to just keep gaining customers and market share. Even as Cisco sort of piled on the pressure, it didn't seem to have any impact.
Arista really rolled with it. They sort of shrugged it off. The other thing is the sort of the tone. Cisco was, as you say, very high dudgeon and sort of taking a moral high ground. And you heard almost nothing from Arista other than, we're in court, we're going to do some technical workarounds, and otherwise business as usual.
Yes, they were very much focused on, this is not relevant, this is not serious. So, you know, really, Arista has been taking market share in the data center at the time. Like, Arista's gone from nothing to about 15% market share in the data center. Now, these are very specific numbers, and you can always lie with numbers by halving and carving. You know, is it just chassis or something? Well, whatever. But the point is that Arista's value has shot up a lot over that period of time, and they are shipping a lot of product. And I think the secret here ultimately is that Arista was making products that customers want. And basically, to my view, they're making a better switch than what Cisco is. It looks the same, operates the same. And customers have basically voted with their purchase orders to say, we would rather buy, not everybody, but enough customers have moved to Arista and said, that's the switch we want to buy. It does what we want. Maybe it's a slightly better price. Maybe it's more stable, more reliable, or better tech support. But that's what, you know, we don't actually want anything more than a simple switch that works the way it's supposed to work, if you know what I mean.
It's a pretty stunning business model, right? Build what the customer wants.
Yeah, well, I mean, coming back to it, I mean, when the court case first came out, it did very much feel like a last gasp of John Chambers, who is known for this sort of, you remember when EMC turned around and started to get in Cisco's face and got VMware when Cisco was about to buy VMware and all that? And John Chambers' reactions was very personal. He went on a bit of a bun fight with EMC for the next 10 years until he left the company. And you do get the view that John Chambers did get spiteful in some cases. And I do think that he felt that Arista sort of some of the people at Arista needed to be slapped down because they took his toys away. But now that Chuck's much more in control, you know, Chuck Robbins is definitely growing into his role as CEO and much more firmly in control. and very much Cisco is not just a networking company anymore. You know, like if you look at the history of the acquisitions, so look at the last four acquisitions, Duo Security, Jasper, and AppDynamics, none of those are networking. They're all new businesses that Cisco wants to enter that sit over in the stack. And Cisco spent like nearly $10 billion on those businesses. The last serious acquisition in data networking was $600 million for Viptela. And that's 2 years ago now. I think it's sort of Chuck just goes like, why are we bothering anymore? You know, the networking is not all that important to us. Let's just take this off the table so I don't have to worry about court cases and get on with the business of working with customers, which I think is a good call. I don't think anybody could see that as anything but a positive.
Certainly not. And also, you know, walking away with $400 million gives Cisco a measure of, I guess I would say, victory that, you know, they're pocketing some money out of this. I wonder how much they spent on it. But you know, $400 million is a decent consolation prize.
I read some financial news on it, and they said it's basically $400 million is about a standing price. It's a good price to be paid here. I think practically on the ground, the flip side of that $400 million, of course, is that Arista's share price promptly shot up 4%. Which, or roughly $760 million. So I don't think they'll mind much.
Well, $400 million for a company like of Arista's size, what are they, like $2 billion annual revenue?
Yeah, well, it is a cash flow hit. So, but their value shot up by $760 million. In other words, the market says, sure, paying Cisco $400 million, but getting out from underneath that is worth $760 million. So,
do you know what I mean? With some financial wrangling, it's a wash for Arista, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but Arista still has to find $400 million in cash to pay Cisco, however it works out. But it's, you know, it's fair money. Cisco didn't get something over the top of them, you know, or didn't extract value that they didn't need to, that wasn't there to be gotten. I think also there's a point here where Cisco sales reps will no doubt be knocking on your door saying, yeah, yeah, we beat Arista. You know, we got them. They agreed that they were naughty. And, you know, just like Cisco sales reps are still out there today telling customers that, wow, we stole their iOS and copied it and all that sort of stuff. That may or may not be true, but it's just not good business to do that. You don't run down your competitors. So if you have a Cisco sales rep, tell him to stop being a child and to grow up and start giving you products that you want and stop slagging off the competitors in the background.
And in the meantime, Cisco and Arista both can focus on actually competing in the market, which is great for everybody.
Well, I think the challenge here is that cloud is their real competitor. If we continue to move down the path of companies moving into the cloud and there's no market left for these companies, right?
Right.
So if they're not careful, if they're really not careful, the business, you know, they could be fighting over, you know, that lawsuits like this could drag on and then it just becomes like, oh, there's nobody left. You know, the market's shrinking. Everybody's moving to cloud. And of course, Arista's got a solid business in the cloud and Cisco hasn't. That's also a differentiator as well.
Although we should also note that Arista is making inroads into the campus as well. They released their spline switch earlier this year and also just acquired Mojo Networks, which is a WLAN company, very clearly starting to infringe on more Cisco territory. And not infringe in the legal sense, but in the competitive sense.
Yeah, well, it's a logical expansion for Arista. I don't think they're going to race into the campus. Arista is very, historically, I see Arista as a very deliberate, very measured approach. You know, they said, we're going into the campus, we're just introducing this chassis switch. And I said, that's not really enough. Remember when we talked about that a couple of weeks ago?
Yep.
That's really not enough. And so now what we've seen is, and now we're partnering with Aruba for the wireless. And I'm always a big fan of partnerships. Don't, you know, if you want casual hookups, that's nice. But if you want to buy it, you need to put a ring on it kind of thing. And I think that, you know, the obvious thing was to say, we'll have partnerships with Aruba. So companies who want a fully established, mature wireless portfolio, and they're looking for campus switches to go on the back of that. Well, then Arista is a possible partnership for the chassis switches. But Aruba's also got chassis switches. I mean, we've covered them in the news a couple of times. They've got new chassis out in the campus stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how much of a partnership HPE and Arista are going to have going forward. In the data center, certainly, but it's not too hard to make a data center switch these days. And you could imagine that HPE, sure, wants to focus on the things that it's doing well and doesn't want to build a networking business, but I think it has to in the long run.
Yeah.
Either that or buy Arista outright, which is unlikely, to be fair.
Yeah, probably. At this point, it doesn't seem like it, no.
No. But then again, can Arista, like at the rate that convergence is happening in the market, what I mean by, you know, look at Nutanix and Cisco's hyper-converged strategies, just how many switches do customers actually need? I'm not sure we actually... there's actually that much of a market going forward. But they obviously think so because they're all making it happen. So who knows? What do I know?
And we'll find out. All right, sticking with Cisco news, SDX Central is reporting that Cisco Viptela's SD-WAN software is now available to run on Cisco's ASR and ISR routers, as well as the ENCS 5000 routers.
good news for everybody. I think this is what we had always hoped when Cisco bought Viptela, was that we could put this code onto their routers. The original plan was to, you know, put x86 blades in the servers. That doesn't seem to have gotten much traction. I think perhaps Cisco has realized that the other SD-WAN competitors are good competitors here. They can't sort of take the time to fiddle around with this for a few years, or the market might actually just pass them by. Companies like Silver Peak, who've been on the show many times, and the other SD-WAN players are got great business models, right? And they've got good products out there, and they're taking sales away. So Cisco has to rush to market here, and getting it onto these existing incumbent hardware boxes makes it really easy for customers to buy it. That is, I can just go to my boss and say, well, we need SD-WAN. We can just upgrade what we've got. We don't have to go to the market. We don't have to go and evaluate competitors.
Yeah.
And that's key, right?
It's an advantage that Cisco has, that they've got this huge install base. I think in the article, they're referencing something like 1 million of these routers out there, which if you can just upgrade it, get this SD-WAN capability with a software upgrade, that's a fantastic advantage for Cisco against, you know, a VeloCloud or a Silver Peak, a Riverbed, and so on.
Yeah, I do. I personally suspect that Cisco's rushed through this. And historically, Cisco hasn't had a good track record of delivering software reliably and well, you know, stable and ready for use. So maybe don't run into this. Maybe put your plans, if you're looking at Cisco and choosing this technology, I would be fairly slow to adopt this and very cautious, because historically Cisco's iOS team hasn't been great at this. That's not to say it's not, it's just to say that historically they haven't. So you want to be careful. Talk with other people, get together in your communities and find somebody, you know, who is a believer and gotten into it, and talk to them about their problems and how their experiences was. Like, one of the things that we learned early on in the iWAN days, for example, is Cisco just kept saying to them, get out there, get in there, get that product, get it. And people just had so much pain deploying iWAN that eventually the feedback was, this isn't going to work. And they ended up buying Viptela. So be careful here. I think Viptela is great technology. It's absolutely part of what Cisco is, and they certainly can get it right. But a little word of caution, Cisco works at such large scale. Its software development processes haven't usually been very modernized or very good. So let's be cautious about how quickly you dive in on that one.
That's right. The other thing that's good for Cisco is that there are many SD-WAN competitors out there saying our SD-WAN box is a router replacement. Having SD-WAN software on the ASR, ISR allows Cisco to counter that message.
And there's also people out there who are using Cisco routers on legacy technologies, you know, frame relay or DS1s or ES1, E1s, and you know, those types of high-speed legacy circuits. And normally that means having a router and putting an SD-WAN appliance behind it.
Right.
You know, I generally would suggest that that's a good idea, but I can also see that you don't want to have two devices at a remote site. You might see that as complexity. So, you know, it's perfectly viable technology. SD-WAN isn't all that hard at the end of the day. If it was hard, there wouldn't be so many startups doing it, if that makes sense.
It does, yes.
Yeah. Startups are really good at doing easy things and then adding some unique value and then leveraging that to grow left and right. They're not usually very good at doing hard things, like really raw, difficult things. And so I don't see SD-WAN as a hugely difficult thing to do. It is. It's certainly a difficult thing to get right operationally and to do all the things that you need to do for customers. But I think this is a really good move from Cisco, and they've done very well by historical standards to get this product to market very quickly. They've only had it, Viptela, for about 18 months. And so this is actually quite unexpected on my part to see them come out so early. So I'm positive that it's here. I'm cautious because I wouldn't rush into this based on the history with Cisco bringing new products to market.
All right, moving on. Let's Encrypt, that's a certificate authority. They offer free digital certificates to websites to help enable HTTPS. They have announced that they are now trusted by all major root programs, including Microsoft, Google, Apple, and Mozilla. The company says older browsers, operating systems, and devices may still not trust Let's Encrypt directly, so the company is maintaining a cross-signing relationship it has with the CA IdenTrust.
Yeah, so this is key. Let's Encrypt came out, and of course, lots of your favorite big vendors have funded Let's Encrypt to make this possible, and it's really fantastic. And the key here is that Let's Encrypt has now actually got their root certificate into all of the major browsers, where before they were countersigned by IdenTrust in the middle.
Yep.
If something had happened to IdenTrust, such as what we've seen with other certificate authorities like Symantec, for example, blew up. The whole business just disappeared. The certificates have been revoked, which is just unheard of. There are good reasons not to trust an intermediate CA. And if everybody's betting, so many people are betting on their businesses and their websites, they're literally gambling that Let's Encrypt is secure and safe as a certificate authority. Having the root certificates in there means that Let's Encrypt is now no longer dependent on IdenTrust, except for legacy. You know, if you've got still running IE8 or something like that, you'll be stuck with Identrust CAs to be trusted until you upgrade. And for everybody who's out there, I mean, so many networking people now, we're all just using Let's Encrypt for VPN services, SSL VPNs and various websites and internal services. It's just way easier to do that than to go and pay for a certificate. So it's good for everybody. And it's good to know that that whole program is moving forward.
That's right. All right, just a break to tell you about today's sponsor, IT Pro TV. Whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned IT professional, IT Pro TV is the only source you'll need. You can learn the skills to pass the most in-demand IT certs from entry-level to advanced with engaging hosts and a talk show-style format. They call it binge-worthy learning, just like you'd binge watch on Netflix. You can binge watch to get your certifications. They have a course library that includes CEH V9, CISA, CompTIA, Mac Certified Support Professional, and more.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I like the idea of having training en masse. That is, you can just get access. One fee gets you all the things that you think you may or may not need. I don't always use all of it, but the ability for when you're having some problems, you might want to get in there and just spend some time getting a bit of an insight into any of the other things. So even if you're a networking person, knowing what's happening on the desktop or, you know, in your MCSEs is actually good skilled things to have.
That's right. And they make it easy to get. You can stream courses live and on demand from your desktop, your mobile device. They're on Apple TV, they're on Roku, they're on Fire TV. So if you want to learn more, go to itpro.tv/network. That's itpro.tv/network. Use the code NETWORKBREAK, and that means you can try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your Aptiv subscription.
So as you sit down this evening with your margarita in front of television, you can watch your IT Pro.
I don't know if a margarita is great for studying, but maybe a notebook and a nice glass of water.
Or not, as the case may be.
That's right. So visit itpro.tv/network. Use the code NETWORKBREAK, and we thank them for sponsoring today's podcast. All right, back to the news. GitHub, I'm sure you've heard of them. They've open sourced a homegrown load balancer. It's called GLB Director. GLB Director is a layer 4 load balancer. It's not meant to replace existing open source load balancers like Hotproxy, HAProxy, or Nginx. But it sits in front of them. It helps ensure that existing TPC connections aren't disrupted as new proxy servers are added to a cluster.
Now, there's a lot of these L4 load balancers coming out from these companies who operate at scale, obviously, as they've built their own back in the day when they needed to have their own. And now they're trying to get them out there so that other people can glom onto the project and then makes, you know, all that sort of stuff.
All the good scale benefits of open source, yes.
That's right, yeah. So it's a layer 4 load. Now, the thing that I really liked about this was that the way they talk about their design methodologies in here as well. So they're not just slapping the code out on the table and saying, hey, come and have some. They're actually talking about practical design methodologies and explaining why L4 load balancing is actually valuable and how you would use this load balancer design to load balance among proxies. So it's particularly useful if you're working with Varnish caches and things like that, where you actually want to do, and you're running at a large enough scale where you're going to have multiple Varnish caches in front of your websites or some other intermediate proxy on the front end or even in the back end. And it's becoming possible to put database caching in the back end. So if you're sharding, sometimes you want to be able to do L4 load balancing in the back. So very interesting. And the fact that it uses DPDK means it runs very, very fast, very, very lean. For those of you who are building virtual clusters, so if you're building NFV type functions where your front end, what you really want is a load balancer, which is low cost. Maybe you're just load balancing, you know, a half a dozen email servers or 3 or 4 web servers. You don't really need, you know, 100 gigabit load balancing, and you don't need a hardware load balancer. The idea would be is to have one of these software load balancers for every service that you have and have lots of them in the VMs around there in your DMZ. And I think this is a pretty good tool. I'd be looking closely at this. But the blog post that goes with it is really interesting reading. It just got me thinking about how this design would work and how they've worked their way through the design. So give the blog post a read. It's in the show notes.
Yeah, and to any folks who work on the marketing side of big vendors, if you're looking at how to write marketing documentation or even regular documentation for your products, read the blog. It's really good.
Yeah, like this is how we think it should go. This is why we did it. Here's the different ways that we did it. It's just great.
Right. And there's no fluff about how it's the leading this and the great that and the blockchain. This is just very clear instructional technical detail, nice and clean. So let's all take a lesson from this blog post, whether
there's
you want to load
few
balance
adjectives.
Or not.
There's very few
adjectives.
Yeah. It's not great or innovative or right. Game changing or, you know, any of that rubbish that people get excited about when they've got nothing to write about.
Yes.
If you ever put the word innovation, game changing, or
market leading, you know, or whatever,
market leading, you've probably got a product that's actually not very good. It's a clear sign that your product actually isn't that great because you're going to start by that point.
That's right. Yes, superlatives make people mistrustful. So anyway, yeah, go check it out. We have a link in the show notes if you want to go check it out. Okay, you've likely read stories about AWS S3 storage buckets that are misconfigured to make them publicly accessible to anyone on the internet. Now Dark Reading's reporting a new twist on the story. The latest misconfigured bucket is actually owned by an Amazon salesperson.
Oh, salespeople. Are they actually? And I think the interesting thing here is that people are actually trying to tar the AWS salesperson as like an AWS spokesperson or person in voice. And really the challenge here is that somebody's obviously just an incompetent idiot. So I do feel sorry for AWS in the sense that one of their idiot employees did something idiot-like, which is, and it's a salesperson. Not unexpected, really, is it?
It's tough. You know, people make mistakes. It's obviously a misconfiguration. And Amazon said, you know, that it doesn't follow our best practices. We should note that the stuff inside the bucket was like pricing details on various AWS configurations. And it also had some apparently discount information for GoDaddy. So nothing that was going to ruin anyone's business. There was no personally identifiable information or major secrets. It's just a little bit embarrassing. But yeah, you feel bad for people when this happens. But also just a continuing reminder, be very careful with how you're configuring your cloud services.
Yeah. On one hand, a salesperson using in the technology that they're selling.
Well, that's a good thing. Yes.
You know, on the positive, on the bad side, completely stuffing it up, only to be expected, to be fair.
We've all learned a valuable lesson here. Okay, moving on. Qualcomm, they have made a deal with Taiwanese regulators to settle antitrust concerns that the Taiwanese government brought against the chipmaker. Under the deal, Taiwan will keep approximately $89 million in fines that Qualcomm's already paid, but it's going to waive the rest of a proposed $773 million fine they originally levied against the company.
Yeah, I think what's important here is that Qualcomm has a long history of using lawsuits and patent law and litigation as a way of getting competitive advantage. I suspect that this is just another step in that direction. I wonder how much longer that strategy is going to last. The point here is that companies like Apple have actually taken Qualcomm on, like cut Qualcomm out to their detriment to some extent, because Qualcomm still does make the best chipset, but the future generations of iPhone won't have Qualcomm chipsets in it because Qualcomm keeps doing this sort of stuff and, you know, using legal lawsuits and abusing patent law and creating fairly arcane business models. I wonder if people are wising up to Qualcomm and going like, yeah, sure, but you're not going to be our primary partner of choice.
Right. And this litigation strategy may be blowing back on them as they're still in potential regulatory trouble with the US, with the EU. This is just one agreement with Taiwan that they're settling. And they're not actually getting off all that scot-free. They have pledged to invest $700 million in Taiwan in research and development over the next 5 years. Although in exchange, they get to keep their rights to charge royalties on their patents, which is how they make the majority of their revenue or their income. So you know, they got something for it, but they've still got a lot of legal hurdles they're facing. And as you mentioned, the ongoing lawsuits with Apple as well.
Yeah, I think the one with Apple is very personal. It has all the stink of like, you know...
It does.
Of like, no, you didn't just mess up. You really messed up. You really offended us. And now we're angry. So we're going to go after you, even to our own detriment, to a lesser or greater degree. So it's an interesting move. Yeah.
When the bully sort of rocks up to the wrong person and thinks they're going to push somebody around and finds out, wait a minute.
it's pretty dodgy what Qualcomm do. What Qualcomm does is they say that the Apple has to pay the licensing fees to the chip makers. And then the chip makers then pay the fees to Qualcomm. But Qualcomm directly controls the pricing that goes to the buyer through the chip maker. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So yes, they get their licensing fees, but they actually control the price and a whole bunch of information, but they don't do it directly. And it's actually like legally, it's a very arcane way to get around things. And so Apple can't go to Qualcomm and say, you know, you're doing it wrong. They say, well, talk to the chip maker. And it's pretty sharp business practice, and I do feel that Qualcomm might struggle going forward. It'll be interesting to see.
Yep. All right, another quick break to tell you about our new membership site. It's called Ignition. It's at ignition.packetpushers.net. We've got free and paid membership tiers, and it's for content meant to drive your professional development. And Greg, you can tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, so Ignition today, it's a way for you to support us. So what we started off, we got the membership site up and running. We've built a whole WordPress platform to be able to membership, and it's linked to Stripe for payments. And we're still working our way through some of the things. So one of the small things, for example, that we discovered and fixed this week was that when you sign up and we send you a receipt, it didn't have a company name on it. So,
which if you're trying to build to your company is tough.
Yeah. So we had to build a receipt so you can click and download a receipt. And then I had to make another change to put the company name on it. Just little things So what we are saying today is we've got lots of content planned, including not just what Ethan and I write and Drew. We're also getting other people in to write content. We're making plans.
I'm in negotiations right now as we speak.
Yeah. So today, it's you want to support the Packet Pushers and help us stay in business, get over to the ignition.packetpushers.net, sign up. There's a paid membership tier. We're building content that premium members, the people who pay for the membership, will be able to access. We're still trying different ideas and working it out. But right now, you can get a hold of my career ebook. I've published a 4-part ebook. It's pretty substantial. It's about 300 pages long that talks about some advice on career, especially useful for those in the middle or in the early stages of their career, and gives you ideas about where things to think about when you're evaluating yourself. So how to go to an interview, what should be mental in preparation for an interview, evaluating yourself in a job, things that I have conversations with people so often when I meet them in person at events and or talk to people online asking for help. So I put it all together in a career ebook, and you can get that as part of your free membership, part of your premium membership.
Right. There's also exclusive blogs. There's videos. Ethan is rolling out a course on QoS fundamentals. He's got a few videos up on that already. And of course, if you like the link propagation and human infrastructure newsletters, those are included with both the free and paid membership tiers. So head on over to ignition.packetpushers.net and check it out. Okay, back to the news. Extreme Networks, they saw its stock price drop approximately 30% after the company reported Q4 and fiscal 2018 financial results. Top line numbers, the full year revenues were $983 million, which is up 62% year over year, but they also posted a net loss on the year of $46.8
million. Yeah, I think they were struggling to sell into the data center is what I saw. Some people saw it as improvements and some of them saw it down. But basically, the management lowered the Q1 2019 guidance, saying that their immediate sales going forward are going to be below. And of course, anybody who's in the enterprise IT shares doesn't like to see you get your forward predictions wrong, and they all run for the door. So,
right. They didn't sell as much as they thought in the last week of the final quarter of 2018, so that dinged them. And they also reduced their guidance on the first two quarters of 2019. That made some investors nervous.
And it wasn't a whole lot. Like, the forward guidance that they gave was $277 million. They only got to $260-odd million. So it's not like they missed by a whole lot, but the market takes that fairly serious. And I'm guessing they must think it must be like problems within the integration of the business. Like, it's the first sign that something is going wrong. It's not working. So get out now and move on to the next acquisition in the share. It's what they call the hot money in the share market. Any sign of any weakness, get out, move on to the next investment sort of thing.
Yeah, I will say that Extreme has bitten off quite a bit by acquiring assets from Brocade and Avaya and trying to integrate all that and rationalize it, normalize it. And they say they're still working on, for instance, streamlining their channel to make distribution a little more flexible. Although they also said that the goal of these acquisitions was to drive them to be a $1 billion company. And based on their revenues for 2018, it seems like they're on their way.
Yeah, they're going to be close to a $1 billion run rate. That is selling roughly $250 million a quarter, which is quite a step up from then. Now, originally, back before they acquired Brocade and Avaya, they were turning over sort of $50 to $100 million a quarter, I think.
Right.
And so this is quite a big ramp up. And the share price has, like, since 2017, has ramped up from $5 to $15. And so, you know, a correction down today from, what was it, $8 to
$7. Around $6.50. Yeah. $6.30.
Yeah. So it's not the end of the world. So I think they're just, you know, hot money's moving out as it moves on, looking for the next investment, time to move out. And if you've got shares dating from 2016, now's a chance to liquidate and cash out and move on to the next thing.
But Avaya's not giving up. They've got plans to streamline and move forward, so we'll keep an eye on what they're up to.
Yeah, actually, we just got news that they're going to sponsor some shows in a few months, so we're going to be hearing more about them, which is good.
Yeah, all right. All right, moving on. VMware, they're acquiring Dell EMC's Service Assurance Suite, which includes software for, quote, network health, performance monitoring, and root cause analysis for communications service providers, end quote. That's from the press release.
Yeah, and you have to sort of sit and go like, huh, what? What's a Service Assurance Suite? So I, like you, had to run off and learn a little bit about it. What I discovered was, first of all, in service assurance is a particular word in telcos, and Wikipedia defines it as application of policies and processes by a communication service provider to ensure that services offered over networks meet a predefined service quality level for an optimal subscriber experience. Decode that at your will. But I think it's actually a software platform that says, you know, if I commission a customer, it needs to do this, this, and this, and these things need to be in place. So it's an orchestration engine was what I read it. And EMC seems to have been building this platform for telcos for, what, 10 years or so? there seems to be acquisitions dating back to sort of the mid-2000s and a chain of acquisitions which seem to have been folded into this product.
Yeah, in the press release, they say the acquisition is going to bolster its telco NFV portfolio. I didn't really realize VMware had a telco NFV portfolio, but they do, and now they're aiming to build it out. Their goal is to help service providers modernize, virtualize, and automate infrastructure. And so I guess they've got some new software and a team of folks to help them do this.
Sure. So if you think, you know, we've talked a lot about things like Cord and the ONF and, you know, all of the OpNFV and all those types of platforms, and telcos are basically looking to use OpenStack and KVM hypervisors to be able to run network functions virtualization. VMware would like to put their product in that mix and ask, hope that there are some telcos out there who would want to use the VMware platform and the VMware hypervisor to do exactly that. And the telcos will be saying, yes, but we need an OpenStack. And the VMware that they have for the enterprise is not that. It's really not scaled up to that level. So it does make sense. I do got to be wondering, though, if Dell must be pleased to get some cash out of VMware, like to pay down debt. You don't think that's like a little part of it?
Oh, I'm sure it is. And it's such a weird sort of deal because of the relationship between Dell and VMware and how they're kind of together but not. And so, yeah, and also we should note that there was no amount of money on how much this acquisition cost released either. It's unknown. Yep. But
so the flip side of this is that the NSX business unit, which has been, you know, working in the data center, is, as we've talked about, moving into the WAN with VeloCloud. And VeloCloud had a substantial telco business. And VMware has had a big telco business or a sales presence trying to get out there and build products for the service providers, seeing it as a major market opportunity. So this service assurance means that they're no longer just trying to sell VMs as such. They're trying to sell a solution. Uh-huh. And something that's been built over a number of years. It was actually built by EMC back long before Dell acquired it. And it has quite a number of customers. The press releases, it pains to point out that it's got 50 telcos at scale. I don't think that you'll see AT&T and Verizon jumping all over this, except maybe in pieces, like some parts of the business. It's just two carriers out there who might be looking at something like this going, we can't do open source, but we could buy something from VMware and have, you know, the high quality, high touch, you know, big name stuff. They might be looking at this as a way to go forward and combine it with the VeloCloud acquisition for, you know, an SD-WAN play. Makes very good sense.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll keep an eye on that as it develops. This is our last sip. As we're recording this episode, the DEF CON event's wrapping up in Las Vegas. One story that caught my attention was the demonstration of an attack that can compromise a pacemaker. So security researchers figured out a way to compromise the medical device that configures the pacemaker so that they could upload malicious firmware that could then cause the pacemaker to malfunction. Whee! the researcher said they notified the pacemaker's manufacturer in 2017, but they also claim that their proof of concept attack still works. For its part, the manufacturer says they have taken steps to address the vulnerability.
Yeah, like this sort of stuff. They also had the voting machines, and they literally had 8-year-olds hacking the voting machines.
Good Lord.
like US voting machines, not, I'm not sure who's got voting machines. But anyway, there's a whole lot of stunting, like security stunting that goes on at these sorts of conferences where security people, you know, try to make fun and lampoon themselves and everybody else. As I've always said, it just looks childish. So this is perfectly viable information presented in such a way that it's meant to be like a quasi comedy, serious, like it's just not very professional.
Well, I didn't see the presentation. I don't know if they lampooned it up or not, but it does seem like important research going on when you're talking about people's health and how technology affects people's health. It's serious. So I'm glad it's happening. I'm glad they're also in touch with the device manufacturer. That's how it should be. We need responsible disclosure. The link to the story is from Ars Technica. They've got a response from the device manufacturer, which I found a little bit troubling. You can go read it for yourself and decide. But one of the things the device manufacturer says is that it's kind of incumbent on the hospital to have a secure, highly secure network. And I was like, oh, well, if that's what it is, then we're all screwed. So,
yeah, you know. Great idea. That has most hospitals don't have secure networks because pacemakers and all the devices connected to it aren't secure.
Yeah, right. It's turtles all the way down.
Who was the company that had the wireless thing, and they actually have a little box that you can plug an insecure device into on an Ethernet jack, and then it's in a microsegment from then on? Is that Aruba?
It might be Aruba. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So they've actually got this little wireless box, and one side's a Wi-Fi, and the other side's an Ethernet port. And if you've got an insecure, you know, scanning machine or
like an MRI or something,
like an MRI or you know whatever it is, you can actually plug it in and then put it in a microsegment.
Yeah,
which is quite a thing, right?
It is quite a thing.
thought that was genius because that's just how insecure your average medical system. It's been like that for 20 years.
Yes, and anything we can do to try to simplify that and provide some basic security controls is a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. So, but I mean, the sort of stunting that's going on in I have a Twitter feed which follows a bunch of people from the security industry, and it's just like there's all this puerile behavior and general stuff, like, you know, one person's having a jiu-jitsu competition as part of their black hat attendance, and another person's doing anti-Vegas Vegas party, and like, it's just, these people should, like, I admire their energy and their folk and their commitment and the passion that they bring to it. On the other side, it's like, if you showed this to grown-ups, they'd be going like, you what that guy is going to be in charge of IT security? Like, what? These people are, you know. So I do, yeah, anyway.
I take your point. I think, you know, there can be some childish behavior in the security community, but I also think in some cases, sometimes you need a little bit of showmanship to get companies and organizations to stand up and take notice and pay attention. So maybe in the end, it's all for the good. I don't know.
Mm. I've said my piece. I'm not going to keep going.
Okay, we won't belabor it.
We won't belabor it. There's nothing to be gained, yeah.
All right, well, if they want to get more from you where you can belabor on other things, where should they go?
You can find me blogging over on Packet Pushers as I wind up my etherealmind.com, and you can find an endless stream of snark on my Twitter handle at etherealmind.
And I'm Drew Conry-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net and also at Ignition. Thanks to our sponsor, IT Pro TV, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or tell somebody about it. You can also check out our membership program, ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got free and paid membership options. If you take the free option, you get the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation Newsletter. Thanks for listening.